This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. 59 years ago, humans first left Earth, and 50 years ago, we landed on the moon. Since then, we've orbited the Earth, sent rovers to Mars, and sent people to live on the International Space Station. It won't be too long before humans make that long journey to Mars to begin our extraterrestrial colonization. Wendy Lawrence is one of the people who has contributed to the collective knowledge that will make that journey possible. The former NASA astronaut is also a retired U.S. Navy captain, a pilot, and an engineer. She'll be in Milwaukee this Sunday to give a talk about her career. It's part of a three-day-long event called the Under One Moon Festival, which is taking place in the Third Ward. We reached Lawrence by phone ahead of her visit here, and she explained that she was first selected to be a shuttle astronaut.
I arrived at NASA in 1992 when NASA was really getting good at figuring out how to fly the space shuttle and fly it regularly. So I finished my initial training flow as an astronaut candidate, and then actually before I finished, got assigned to my first mission. So I felt very, very privileged to be at NASA at that point in time.
We no longer have the shuttle, and we depend on the Russians now to get astronauts to and from the International Space Station. During the time that you were flying those shuttle missions, was there an idea that this was going to go away?
Well, I think in that business, you're always looking at what you want to do next, because when you come from the world of aviation, you understand that you're only going to get so many flight hours out of whatever it is you're operating. And so you're always thinking about, what is it that we want to do next? Even when I got to NASA at 92, there was a strong desire to do what we did do during Apollo. We had been in low Earth orbit for a while, but all of our sights still were set much farther away. We needed to do the International Space Station because you need to get experience with humans being in space for much longer periods of time. Not only do the astronauts need that experience, the people who work in mission control, the people who plan the mission need that experience. And so I'm all for going back to the moon because I think like an engineer, I want to go test everything out on the moon, but I don't want that to be the final destination. I think we need to continue to push the boundaries. Mars is doable, and so that's where you set your sights next. But the path, in my opinion, definitely needs to go through the moon.
I have a regular segment here on the show with a local astronomer, astrophysicist, and we talk about space travel, space life quite a lot because of so many of the problems that haven't yet been solved. Like, what do we do about long-term radiation, and what do we do about long-term weightlessness and what that does to the human body? You're retired now, but you were very actively involved in it at the time. When you look at what NASA and scientists are doing now, are you hopeful we're going to get to Mars?
Yes, I am. Back to radiation. Still a big problem. There's a type of radiation called galactic cosmic radiation that is very, very difficult to protect the astronauts from because we're talking about bits of atoms, so particles with a very high amount of energy. And to effectively shield your spacecraft from that, that's the technical challenge that still hasn't quite been solved. We're making good progress on it, but that one really, to me, is probably the top technical challenge. Because we've had astronauts now on the International Space Station for so many years and spending longer amounts of time there, we've gotten a good understanding of what to do to keep them from impacting their bone health and losing muscle mass and muscle strength. Exercise is the key. Fortunately, astronauts have to do a lot of it, but that seems to be working quite well. So when we head off to Mars and we have a level of gravity, will that help? Absolutely. Is it going to be enough? That's still an unknown.
The science fiction kid in me of course, wants to go. I mean, I just think it's fabulous. I want us to get out there and, you know, be the Star Trek that actually was only on television. You know, I want that to actually be reality. But I know,
me too.
But I know there's so much that we have to do that, of course, a television show didn't have to do. You just kind of create the world and say, well, this is how it works. And then there's also the psychological aspects of long-term space travel.
And I think people are going to look at the International Space Station and say they did a couple of really great things. One, it showed that countries across the world can work together and be very, very successful on ambitious projects. If they set their mind to it, is absolutely doable. But I think from a mission planning point of view and a mission support point of view, one of the most important lessons we've learned is how to support the crews better psychologically. Because NASA, with its first group of astronauts all being test pilots, you can definitely think right stuff here, that was very much discounted. But we've seen that it is critically important for keeping the crews healthy and happy.
So in the early days, there was very much that military mindset of just suck it up?
Oh, yeah. That's an understatement.
Well, that's good to know that that's changed somewhat. Do you feel like it's been enough?
My last job in the astronaut office was supporting the first 14 crews that went up to the space station. And, you know, I would say probably never enough, but certainly so much better than it was, and probably more than adequate. Technology, wonderful. We take advantage of it. We use it to connect the crews with their families. There's a telephone on the space station. If they want to call Earth, they can. And so that creates that sense of connection, because they don't feel like, well, I'm not able to talk to anybody until I get to Sunday. I can email, but if I really wanted just to pick up the phone and have a two-way conversation, I can do that. What's going to be fascinating, though, is when we send those crews to Mars and when that two-way conversation is no longer an option. Psychological support for those crews, I think, is going to be quite challenging. So hopefully we've learned enough from the Russians with their extensive space station history, with our own operations on board the International Space Station. Hopefully we've learned enough, but I hope people do not discount the challenges that time delay and communication for that first crew that goes to Mars.
Yeah, I'm sitting here nodding. You can't see me, but I was thinking the same thing, that we're not going to be able to have a telephone on whatever spacecraft that is. And we hope there's going to be connection once the landing happens. But again, it's going to be delayed by how much? How long would that delay be?
It depends on the relationship of the Earth's alignment with Mars. But generally, you know, you could have, I think, up to a 20-minute time delay round trip. So it really changes from a crew's point of view when you're training with your flight control team. It changes how you're going to interact, because we got spoiled on the shuttle. We're still spoiled on the station. If I have a question, I can just call the ground. Somebody else can look it up for me and get me back an answer in a very short period of time. Oftentimes, they already have the answer, and it's an immediate response. You don't aren't going to be able to do that on Mars. So if you have an emergency, that crew got to figure it out on their own. They have to be pretty much entirely self-sufficient.
And that's tough over time.
Yes, yes, because invariably, if you're operating a new spacecraft, you realize we don't know everything there is to know. Even though we sat and we pondered and we what if, there's always something that surprises you. And that crew, when that moment happens, they're going to have to look at one another and say, between all of us, can we figure this out?
What do you think is the optimum number of people, assuming all other things being equal, that should be on that first mission? What's the right number so that you have enough minds working on problems like that?
Probably beyond three. I just think there's going to be so much to accomplish that there's no way that three people could learn it well enough. You know, then you start looking at spacecraft design, because landing a significant amount of mass down on Mars is not an easy problem either. That's another technological hurdle we have to figure out. So, I don't know. And I'm a proponent of an odd number for decision making. Kind of back to that psychological discussion. So maybe five. You know, if you had, could have a crew of seven, that would be awesome. It may really stretch what you're able to do with your spacecraft lander, however. So I don't think three. I don't think you can go entirely with the Apollo model. So for now, my wag at it, I'd say maybe a crew of five.
I'm asking you to put your seeing into the future hat on, but when are we likely to see a crew making that first attempt?
Not next decade. Well, actually, that's a good question for Congress. Like, how much money are you willing to give NASA?
That's always a good
really
question.
It really does boil down to funding, because this year being the 50th year of Apollo, some people focused on the amount of money that NASA had back then, and it was a significant part of the budget, up around 5%. Now it's less than 0.5%. So not so much the amount, it's the fact that Congress likes to change it year after year, and that's what makes your mission planning and what we're going to do, what we're how we're going to design the spacecraft, what capabilities we're going to build into it. If that amount of money changes year after year, it is very, very difficult to be successful in meeting your requirements. You have to constantly replan, and that wastes time and it wastes money. So I'd say if we can get all the presidential administrations between now and then and Congress to just commit to the amount of money, give NASA the mission like President Kennedy did, and then give them a pretty stable budget, I think 2030 timeframe is very doable. There are a lot of ifs in there.
Yeah, there are. And I was going to say, do you think we have the cultural and political will that we did in the 60s to do that? I mean, everybody seemed to be, I'm sure there were naysayers, but everyone seemed to be pretty much on board in the 60s to get that to happen.
And there were different, you know, kind of an engineering term I'll use, forcing functions involved in that. It was really more of a political contest than anything else. It's a great question. I think if we can convince people of the value from a technology perspective, then we could get that commitment. I mean, we're still talking about benefits from the Apollo program in terms of technology spinoffs. The fact that I am talking to you on my cell phone, my mobile device that has more computing power than we used in the Apollo program, actually is thanks to the Apollo program and the fact that we had to miniaturize computer components. And then smart people outside of NASA looked at that and saw applications for their businesses, their industries, and they continued that development.
Well, that leads me to the reason you're coming here and the reason, you know, we're having this conversation, which is actually you're coming to speak, but it's around what's essentially an art installation and a way of thinking and approaching the moon and space and the idea of that. And do you think things like this are important to help maybe reignite that passion that we had in the 60s for this kind of thing?
I like to quote Dr. Sally Ride in instances like this, because she said, and I think it is just so accurate, you can't be what you can't see. And yes, creating that image for young people in particular is powerful. So if we can do that through art, that is wonderful. It is necessary. Just create that spark to jumpstart their imagination, to help them see what is possible for them. So yes, and that's why when people talk about, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math education, and they want to add in A for art, I'm all for that, because everybody learns in a different way. And if you can present the information in a variety of ways, that's more powerful. You know, a good engineer is a bit of an architect and an artist, you know, because if you're tasked to design something, you know, you want it to have a certain... Yeah, well, Tesla is a good example. It's a sleek-looking car. It's pushing the engineering boundaries of electrical vehicles. So, you know, you can't just always be numbers and solving that equation. And we say form and function. So that form is the art aspect. Yes, it's got a function, but you want to have an appeal to other people as well. And that's where the form, the art, comes in, because you got to catch that person's eye.
Wendy Lawrence, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for your work, and we're looking forward to having you here in town.
Thank you, Bonnie. I'm looking forward to it as well. I have only ever passed through the airport, so I've had no opportunity ever to be in the downtown area of Milwaukee, so I'm very much looking forward to that.
Wendy Lawrence is a retired U.S. Navy captain, a former helicopter pilot, an engineer, and a former NASA astronaut. She will be in Milwaukee this Sunday as part of the Under One Moon pop-up festival, which is taking place in the Third Ward. There is a link to more information at WUWM.com.